Today he will be discussing his book, Spy Trade, The Myths and Reality of U.S.-Israel Economic Relations, as well as challenging the facts and representations made at the February 23rd campus presentation by author Dan Senor of the book Startup Nation, The Story of Israel's Economic Miracle. So, without further ado, I'm honored to introduce to you Mr. Grant F. Smith.
I'd like to thank Ms. Roberti for inviting me in the Finance and Economics Council. As she mentioned, I'm here for a specific reason. And I think you'll find out I've got an interesting point of view that's quite different than what was presented on campus by Dan Senor in his February presentation. 2009, there were two books that came out which focused intently on U.S.-Israeli economic development and trade relations. One of them is a huge bestseller. Guess which one that is? It's not mine. One of them is an okay seller. That's Spy Trade. But the important thing to realize is that big ideas, large policy initiatives, and there's clearly one behind Startup Nation, can have gigantic policy consequences costing billions of dollars. And that's exactly what my book, Spy Trade, attempts to look at. Now, the two books are completely different in approach. I do recommend that everybody read Startup Nation. It's a fascinating book. It's got Harvard Business School quality case studies. It's got pithy quotes. It's got very interesting ideas. The best one, I think, is the idea of irreverence and challenging and not accepting authority or convention, the idea of chutzpah, the idea of Israeli executives being beat up by their minions who are challenging their authority and ideas. But it's also got a package in its recommendations. And I would argue, and will argue tonight, that the fundamental input and research into this book is incomplete, and that therefore the recommendations that come out of it are faulty and could have disastrous consequences. The other book, Spy Trade, is based on years of bothering the U.S. Trade Representative, the International Trade Commission, the CIA, the Department of Defense, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, to release all of the documents about what was occurring at the level of national security and covert relations during the formation of America's first bilateral free trade agreement. It takes the view that because of promises made for covert operations and cover-ups and the disenfranchisement of U.S. industries and industry groups, that there's some very big, very unsustainable problems that have guided subsequent trade policy, but in particular affect this particular relationship. So it's, I think, incumbent upon me to tell you at least one chapter from my book about this approach. Spy Trade really begins looking at a period of time that's remarkably similar today, where you have kleptocratic regimes being overthrown by popular revolutions. In 1979, this meant the Somoza regime in Nicaragua and, of course, the Shah in Iran, which were governing with unpopular regimes with quite a bit of support from the United States and from Israel. In fact, Israel was pumping in hundreds of millions of dollars to prop up their market in Nicaragua right up until the fall of the Somozas. They wanted that market back. The U.S. similarly which had a hand in installing the Shah in Iran, also wanted that market back and was willing to do quite a bit to get it. The early 80s were the period in time in which the United States and Israel were signing a lot of defense agreements and beginning to engage in covert operations, which affected trade policy in ways that you might not expect. One particularly important group in terms of ideas was the Kenya Group, a group of Israeli operatives, an American arms smuggler, a Saudi arms merchant, who had decided that they were going to try and recapture some of these lost markets by financing an arms stockpile that they could continue to deliver to friends or make friends in the former regimes to help win back some of these markets. A perfectly logical proposition. And so some of these sales were openly done by the Israelis, particularly a $27 million sale in 1982. And this was sold to the U.S. Department of Defense to circumvent congressional bans on aid imposed on the Central Intelligence Agency and Department of Defense on any aid to the Contras in Nicaragua. The Israelis pitched their arsenal plan, wound up getting the bad end of the deal, it turns out, but we'll look at that later. Even as elements in the U.S. Army were protesting, saying, this is not the way to do business. If you want to support the Contras and bring back a friendly government in Nicaragua, you should advise Congress and do it legally. This is the buds of what became the Iran-Contra scandal, which, when I was your age sitting in your seat, became a constitutional crisis of gigantic proportion. The Department of Defense, in a secret arrangement called Tipped Kettle, arranged to buy Israeli captured Palestinian weapons and was happily funneling them to their friends, the Contras, in Central America to win back Nicaragua. Again, as part of Ronald Reagan's vision of fighting the Soviets in every hemisphere. And in exchange, according to documents declassified in the Iran-Contra hearings, after all of this blew up, the Department of Defense guaranteed military and, in particular, enhanced economic help to Israel. These guarantees would have an effect on the development of the bilateral free trade agreements, but the military-to-military development between the two countries was ongoing from the 1970s. The U.S. saw Israel as a Cold War ally. They had beaten up countries in the Six-Day War in 1967, and that merited a lot of attention from the Department of Defense. This led to the exchange of data to develop electronic warfare. It led to offering Israel the ability to sell into the Department of Defense just like a NATO ally. It led to strategic cooperation agreements. It led to a commitment to buy $200 million worth of weapons every year. But these were memorandums of understanding. And Israel's biggest ally in the United States, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, wanted a permanent, binding, non-renewable commitment. And so it issued a series of reports making the case that the U.S. and Israel should be partners, that Israel should be working to provide medical support, that it should be providing goods and services just like a NATO ally. So this lobbying was ongoing. But the big enchilada was when the free trade agreement was proposed. Now, after World War II, when the U.S. was a dominant economic power, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, and the idea that everybody should lower tariffs was in place. But within that trading scheme, you could also have bilateral deals with key trading partners where you'd offer enhanced market access. And so U.S. industries were startled, some of them, to read in the Federal Register, the main way the federal government announces new initiatives to the United States, that on February 15th, 1984, they would be invited to fast-track free trade agreement negotiations to lead to the first free trade agreement with Israel. Now, they were advised that the process was fairly simple. There would be an open hearing, their only chance for advice and consent, in which they could testify in front of the International Trade Commission in the spring of 1984. Then the executive would study, it would decide which industries in the U.S. should be protected, which not, negotiate with the Israelis, send the thing to both executives to sign, ratified in Congress. But Congress would not be able to pick it apart and say, no, I want to protect the apple growers in my region, or I want to protect this infant industry. It was an up or down vote. That's what made it fast track. And that's what made it dangerous. Every single American industry that went into this process should have, in reality, run. Why? Those lobbying against this free trade agreement, and by the way, if you looked up in The Wealth of Nations by Adam Smith or David Ricardo's Economic Treatise, they would talk about free trade as something radically different than what we talk about today. To them, free trade was one nation and another nation exchanging goods and creating more wealth through comparative advantage. It didn't even involve governments. At best, the original economic thinkers would call what was being negotiated some sort of intergovernmental bilateral trade agreement, but they wouldn't necessarily call it free trade. The American contingent lobbying against this free trade agreement was enormous. The AFL-CIO didn't want it. They saw it as a creeping way to lower wages. The American bromine industry saw a competitor. Israel and the U.S. are the biggest bromine producers. It's a very important chemical. It's used as fuel additives and whatnot. The Monsanto had bad experiences with international trade, and in particular protecting patent rights in Israel, and Droli suggested that if the U.S. wanted to accelerate trade, it should really look at developed countries and not developing countries. Those lobbying for the free trade agreement consisted of a lot of organizations that didn't have much to do with international trade. The most important banks and some manufacturers, but the one that was really calling the shots and driving the process, of course, is the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Its executive director advised the U.S. sternly that it should not protect any industries whatsoever, that it should instead make sure that it wasn't creating exclusion after exclusion, and that it should maintain the U.S.'s participation in this market, which was negotiating with the European community at that time for a free trade agreement as well. So the lobbying was going along about the way you would expect it until espionage. When a delegation of Department of Commerce officials traveled to Jerusalem in spring to begin one-on-one negotiations, they quickly learned that the Israelis had access to all of the confidential business data, market share data, and information submitted by U.S. companies for consideration by the U.S. Trade Representative. Now again, in this federal notice, all of them had been assured that if they wanted the best deal, they better be ready to submit their best argument for why or why not they should be protected. What they found out in Jerusalem is that the U.S. Embassy here in Washington, D.C. had forwarded all of the confidential negotiation points. Now, this didn't fluster AIPAC, which issued a 46-page memorandum stating clearly that, hey, both sides will gain. There are at least 13 U.S. industries that will get a great deal out of this. But the problem couldn't be avoided. The U.S. bromine industry, which wanted to protect itself, had had then-Governor Bill Clinton come up to Washington and say, hey, there are two counties producing this stuff. We got a few thousand jobs. They don't want to compete against a state-owned industry. They went after the process was well underway and asked just how much of our information was lost. And you have to think about this from a marketing and sales standpoint. They lost everything to a new market entrant. Production cost, shipping cost, the cost of depreciation of equipment. Information that any new entrant to the market would have wanted, they wrapped it up in a bowl and lost it to a gigantic competitor coming into the market. The campaign went on. Dan Halpern, Minister of Economics from the Israeli embassy, told the U.S. and the New York Times that the U.S. would have to open up its market. They would have to do at least this to maintain a 20% share of Israel's market, which is remarkably prescient, since that's about what the U.S. has today. The New York Times talked about industries that would be negatively affected and admitted that, well, this is primarily a way to help countries we consider strategically important. It's a way of helping countries we consider politically important. The Providence, Rhode Island Journal was a little bit more blunt. They simply said that any time a country opens its market to a less developed market, what it's doing is essentially guaranteeing that the other market will benefit more, particularly if it's allowed to maintain obstacles. This should be seen as foreign aid and not trade. Reagan got a lot out of the free trade agreements and won a landslide election on this and other issues. The free trade agreement was ultimately signed and ratified on September 1, 1985, and the covert operations that we talked about at the beginning went on apace. In 1985 and 86, the two came together. Jonathan Pollard, an Israeli spy who stole a million documents, quickly blew the U.S.-Israeli relationship apart only 1 month after this trade pact had been signed, upsetting everybody. The FBI, seeing this as part of a larger espionage network, reopened its investigation of both the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee and any people who had information in how all of this confidential U.S. trade data had been lost. The AIPAC employees got lawyered up. And by the way, all this information declassified in 2009. Nobody really knew what happened until the FBI finally let loose these documents. They quickly admitted that, you know what? When we obtained this document and were ordered to return it, we made a copy before we gave it back. And the agents were stunned. They were filling out form FD-302s because they wanted to prosecute. They were out for blood. They wanted people to pay back for the loss of this data. Oh, and by the way, we also got the report from the Israeli embassy. Dan Halpern, to be exact, gave it to us. So, after consultations with the U.S. Department of State, the FBI investigation turned to the Israeli embassy and met with Dan Halpern, who admitted two things very quickly. Number one, yes, I obtained the secret report and I gave it to AIPAC. I wanted them to lobby for the best agreement they could get. Number two, I'm claiming diplomatic immunity from prosecution. You can't touch me. And then he went on to give the FBI agents a dose of reality, stating that maybe this is a little bit above their pay grade. He told them an American was concerned that the U.S. was not holding up its end of the bargain. And this clearly means the U.S. was not upholding its end of the bargain, the Department of Defense agreement to boost the economy, not make waves, and pass this agreement without a hitch. Dan Halperin was essentially telling the FBI that what he was doing was cashing in for the covert operation support. Now, the U.S. Trade Representative refuses to declassify that 300-page report. And I see this a lot because I've been going after government documents for 10 years. Whenever there's something really juicy politically, whenever there's crime involved with governments acting badly, what do? They don't release it under national security. This will damage national security. Even though the FBI had already stated that this report contained no national defense information whatsoever. It's bromine prices. Valuable stuff to the right people, but not of national defense caliber. Who won in all of this? Well, nobody really on the covert operations side. The Contras had a rough time, and the entire Iran-Contra funding, the weapons from Israel into Nicaragua, this later blossomed into U.S. weapons being sold to Iran to free hostages, none of that stuff worked out. It was all exposed in the Lebanese newspaper. It exploded into the media. Reagan lost 20 points, and the thing looked like a scandal that was going to take down the government. People were indicted. They were prosecuted. Felony convictions, which were only unwound during the George H.W. Bush pardons. The FBI hit a roadblock with Halperin. He was saying, look, we're giving you covert assistance. You're giving us economic assistance. What's the problem? The DOJ terminates the FBI investigation, never quite knowing what was going on. So what SpyTrade is arguing in this case, oh, and by the way, the Israelis never got their money for the captured Palestinian weapons. They were trying to submit a bill for the next couple of years. The Department of Defense never paid it. The operation was a success. We did everything you told us to do. Why don't you pay us? And they never got paid. But what lasted? The Soviet Union's collapsed. Daniel Ortega was elected in 2006. George Bush called him and said, congratulations. All of the reasons the U.S. tried to get into Iran through weapons sales didn't work out. What has lasted? The free trade agreement. And the question is, what are we getting for all of this? Israel continues to have wonderful trade preferences with the U.S. A 20% ad valorem tariff, corrective surcharges, duties in the event of any devaluation, floating infant industry protection. So what we have here is a closed trading system that can close itself and an open one. You have an export promotion on one side, you have the benefactor on the other. And as you might expect, this has produced an anomaly, a trade anomaly in all of our bilateral agreements. We have bilateral agreements with Singapore, Australia, Chile. We're negotiating one with Colombia. That'll probably pass soon, Oman. But there's only one which has produced a consistent and ongoing deficit. And it's been about $10 billion over the last 10 years. The U.S. sells 11 into Israel. Israel sells 20.8 billion into the U.S. Trade and services, which isn't even managed that much by the agreement, is about what you'd expect it to be because nobody has a built-in advantage. It's about even. And if you compare this trade agreement with all of our other bilateral agreements, a pattern emerges. I had a chance during research for my book to call Martin Indyk, who was the guy in charge of APAC research for the trade negotiations. And he didn't want to talk about the classified report. Didn't want to get into that. But he did say something that was very intelligent. He said, you know what this really was? For Reagan, it was a wedge to open up Congress to free trade agreements. It was something that AIPAC could help them with that would let them pass something they really wanted. And the question is, though, and he's mentioned this over and over again as a major policy impact on trade deals ever since and on trade policy in general, did we really get that much out of it? I would agree with Indyk that it had a tremendous impact, but the U.S. trade deficit when this was passed in 1985 was minuscule compared to the half a trillion dollars it's reached today. The Obama administration is running in place trying to come up with their new export initiative in which they're going to suddenly reverse this and export more than we import, but we're Americans. We love foreign goods. What are we going to do? Make stuff and sell it? Again, the anomaly is clear. In the U.S.-Chile FTA, there's no trade preference. Sometimes we benefit more than they do. It's a random walk. We had a $3.9 billion surplus last year. The U.S.-Singapore, $11.7 billion. But what you see over time, if you aggregate all of the trade agreements, all of the other bilaterals, is that they work. They produce enhanced bilateral trade. It outpaces general trade growth by 100 points, but it doesn't give an advantage to anyone. And the question is, again, if you're giving an advantage to somebody, what do you get in return? In this case, the research, the declassified documents reveal what the press said back in 1985. This is mainly foreign aid. Few of the benefits promised to the U.S. ever materialized. Worst of all, the process hurt every U.S. industry that counted on the U.S. government to protect its data. It was related to covert overseas operations and payback that Americans mostly never knew about. It tended to abuse U.S. laws and regulations. And again, I keep harping on this point, it seems as though the U.S. could demand a lot more in exchange for such preferential access. And this is where these two books split. There are some really wonderful presentations by Dan Senior of his book. But his book is so full of errors of omission and a distorted view of reality that some of the dangerous recommendations that come out of it should raise alarm. The two paths suggested by these books are quite different. Spy trade is all about accountability. Accountability. Startup Nation is very much about creating new markets, harvesting U.S. demand. And the single best idea, which I've already mentioned and love, is the idea of the irreverence, that you can encourage innovation and startups by being less reverential to authority, to market leaders, to thought leaders. And I really wish more major U.S. companies could do that, be irreverent in the boardroom, and they can't. But the single biggest problem is that it's all about supply and nothing about demand. All about supply and nothing about demand. In particular, in a region that is now reaching $1 trillion in the 22-country Arab League market in terms of import demand, Senior could not imagine ever serving that market. He could imagine serving high-tech markets overseas, but couldn't quite imagine the idea of serving that local market demand. And it also ignores how a lot of that innovative supply was created. But again, this 40% piece of the pie, the U.S. is bringing in 40% of Israel's total exports, to me, is something that would have warranted mention in the book Startup Nation. And the other thing that warranted mention is, where did a lot of that innovation come from? statistically and by data, the Israeli economy has benefited enormously from violating intellectual property rights of other countries, from outright theft of capital goods, of patents. In fact, the second largest export, which went from virtually nothing two decades ago to $5.3 billion, is today a major conflict between the two countries and probably not sustainable. In 1967, Israel said to every pharmaceutical producer, if you do not actively market your product in our country, you don't have any patent rights. We'll copy it and sell it. So you better come into our market. In 1984, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee told U.S. pharmaceutical makers, you need to be in the Israeli market. Don't give short shrift to this market. And ever since then, clinical dossiers, which are required to be submitted to the Ministry of Health, have provided an unending supply of formulas that could then be subtly changed with inert compounds and relaunched as at-risk products in the U.S. market. And this has created a billion-dollar industry for the Israelis, and they're very open about the fact that they'd sure like to protect that. Israeli generics producers can, as one market analyst said, capture 80% of an innovator's market. Not by innovating, but by copying and patent challenges. So in the pharmaceutical area, you don't find much information in Startup Nation about that type of innovation, because it's not innovation. And it led to an agreement in which Israelis would finally harmonize their intellectual property laws with developed country standards and stop doing this type of at-risk launch. And in that way, stay off the punitive U.S. Trade Representative list of intellectual property violators. So that, I think, is one issue in terms of generating supply that should have been included. But the other big one is the Israeli nuclear weapons program. Now, the book is a wonderful read in that it considers not just businesses as startups, but the entire country as a startup. And surely, going from a desert backwater in 20 years to a world nuclear power was a heck of a startup. But this book omits references and actually subjects itself, although it's published in the United States, subjects itself to Israeli military censorship protocols. So when it talks about nuclear weapons, it doesn't say anything more than nuclear capabilities, and it uses a trick that Israeli journalists use to get around the censor, citing foreign press reporting on that it's allegedly a nuclear power. Although it does take credit, as it should, for the fact that in 2005 it was the world's 10th largest nuclear patent innovator. That's certainly true. But by failing to address this issue honestly as part of its startup theme, it really calls into question a lot of the rest of the book, because this would have been a big one in any discussion of startup nations. And it's had a massive impact on the United States because, like some other actions, the U.S. never wanted this country to go nuclear. In fact, the Kennedy administration worked assiduously pressuring for international inspections of the Dimona plant, pressuring the Israelis not to go nuclear, had the CIA study what would happen if they did, and the CIA found out that, you know what would happen if they go nuclear? What will happen is they'll be less inclined to be pressured into agreements they don't like. They'll have a better sense of security and self-reliance. Good things for them, not such good things for the U.S., which wanted to have more influence and more power over this, but lost control of its own industrial base. There's a continuing declassification process going on with the NUMEC case. The NUMEC case is the Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation in Pennsylvania, which was the site of a massive loss of highly enriched uranium during the time that Israel was wrapping up its nuclear weapons program. Four people applied for the right to visit the NUMEC plant with the Atomic Energy Commission, and that's defunct now, but they told the AEC they were variously engaged in thermal electronics and needed to visit the plant. In reality, we now know, thanks to tell-all histories, that the top project director of the Rafael nuclear bomb project visited, that Ephraim Begin, head of Israeli Technical Services for Secret Services, was there. Rafael Iten, who was a big person in terms of putting together the LACOM economic espionage network in the U.S. and his right-hand man on overseas operations, was there. This guy's a hero. He brought in some Nazi war criminals, but he also spent a lot of time targeting U.S. industrial capacity. And in fact, the U.S. played an inadvertent role by supplying a great amount of highly enriched uranium. NUMEC was the plant that lost more highly enriched uranium through 1968 than any other reprocessing facility, but it's not all circumstantial. At the same time, the U.S. was saying, no, don't go nuclear. We don't want to participate in this. Nuclear material is flowing right out of the U.S. Carl Duckett, who was deputy director of the CIA's Division of Operations, said clearly, NUMEC material has gone into this foreign weapons program. John Haddon, the CIA Tel Aviv station chief, said unequivocally that this was an Israeli operation from the beginning, having studied the fact that David Lowenthal, very tightly linked to Israeli intelligence, provided the startup capital for this plant. Abner Cohen, Nuclear Regulatory Commission officials Galinsky and Matten, in the 2010 Bulletin of Atomic Scientists article, all say that the U.S. participated inadvertently in arming Israel against the will of politicians and elected officials. This is a huge story. A Startup Nation book should have written something about this. There is a hero in this book. That hero, Shimon Peres, receives a lot of ink as the father of the Startup Nation. If Dan Senior, who works at the Council on Foreign Relations, had tiptoed across the floor, the aisle, and hauled into the next office, he would have met Sasha Polakow-Saransky, who, doing research with the South Africans, discovered that Shimon Peres actually offered nuclear-tipped Jericho missiles to apartheid South Africa. Why can't that be in the nuclear entrepreneurship section of Startup Nation? But I'm just picking out some of the biggest examples. If you're going to take an honest approach to how the U.S. and Israel have interacted since 1945, you have to mention, and he does mention David Ben-Gurion's emissaries to the United States, you have to mention the massive Haganah smuggling network that was put in place in this country to arm Israel for its war of independence. In the midst of the War Assets Administration's attempt to turn into scrap all of the surplus U.S. weaponry from the Second World War and arms export controls designed to keep all of the World War II surplus from flowing overseas, David Ben-Gurion successfully put together a network with Rudolf Sonnenborn that was able to move tons of smuggled weapons from the U.S. to Israel. In the 1960s, it was nuclear materials. In the 1980s, 70s and 80s, it was weapons-related designs. 86, 87, Pollard with National Defense Information, and we've got recent cases still pending of people supposedly going after Akamai's data, supposedly being willing to sell nuclear-related and spatial and satellite-related intellectual property. Now, weapons are one of Israel's top exports. It's gone from a top 20 to a top 10 exporter. Not so much through innovation as a startup nation, which is why he mainly avoids the topic, but from the successful copying of a lot of the systems that it's been able to receive from the United States. And unfortunately for the United States, we have very aggressive vendors of Sidewinder missiles, very aggressive vendors of Patriot missile batteries, very aggressive vendors. And what they can't sell to anybody who has cash, well, at times Israelis have been willing to sell a very similar system that they sometimes market as 90% U.S. design, and which has sometimes ended up on a battlefield opposite U.S. Marines, such as in the case of tank sites in Iraq. So this is a vital part. Military-industrial espionage has had a vital role in the startup nation. Now, the two books have their heroes and villains. In Startup Nation, Adolf Schwimmer, who was a very entrepreneurial guy who smuggled transport aircraft in violation of arms export controls for fighting the War of Independence, as a swashbuckler. He later appeared in the Iran-Contra scandal as an arms broker. But the problem is idea exchange. There's a pithy quote in here that says, if I have an idea and you have an idea and we trade them, then we both have two ideas. And that's great. But if I have a secret, if I have a weapon system and you steal it, then I have to redevelop it and you can commercialize it wherever you want. So it's clearly not a sustainable model. Startup Nation is about breaking conventions, but if you look at history, the history is also about breaking laws. One of the biggest problems with Startup Nation is that it wants to sell constant conflict, which the authors allege is vital to having created entrepreneurial economy. They would like the West to recognize that as a competitive advantage. So again, the West, or at least the U.S., is iffy about the nuclear weapons capability, and now we're being asked to also consider that constant conflict is from now on going to be a competitive advantage. Does the West really want that? Does the West really want to accept that at this point? Senor is also very persuasive in saying that the West owes this to Israel. But I would say in the case of the U.S., given all of the past trafficking, unfair advantages in terms of the process with U.S. companies, military-industrial espionage, is that really true? Do we really owe that much more? This is a beautiful idea. I wish more Americans adopted this questioning attitude. Because the real question is, how long can this last? Is this sustainable? U.S. industries, how long are they going to be participants in this type of trade agreement? Where's the accountability? Are we arriving at an inflection point where so many people, like our friends across North Africa and the Arab world, who are fed up, how much longer are they going to accept in our WikiLeaks instant disclosure world? None of these secrets would have lasted this long today, I'm sure. How much longer will it last? The other problem is this problem that the U.S. should really militarize. One of the recommendations in this book, which I would argue is a flawed recommendation because it didn't consider all of the proper inputs, is that national service creates entrepreneurship. Does it really? Is the only way to achieve the sort of unity and network that you need to be a successful entrepreneur come from, you know, being in the heat of battle and constant conflict? I'm not sure that that's something the U.S. should accept, a recommendation the U.S. should accept. Again, this, yeah, we'll take this, but does international market insight come from a gun sight? There are lots of Israeli companies that have sprung from the intelligence services, but is that the only way to do it? Isn't it kind of convenient that the single worst idea that came out of this book just happens to recommend that the U.S. bulk up its military forces? You know, given the rest of the book, did he maybe start with that idea and then fill in the rest? I don't know. I question it. And I could mention some other manifestos that have led the U.S. down the wrong path that received as much popular attention as this book did. But if I could leave you with anything, it's that these bad policy ideas that slosh around and that you might get a glimpse of as a student or maybe as a voter have real economic consequences. If you look at that $10 billion sustained deficit that we have with our partner Israel, the Obama administration says about $445,000 in exports are needed to sustain one direct export job. With a deficit of $10 billion, that's about 20,000 jobs, high-paying jobs, not McDonald's jobs. I know some McDonald's jobs have been offered. And indirect jobs with a multiplier of two. So how many jobs are in play for that in today's treacherous economy? 67,000, 68,000? That's 33,729 for each side. That's how much each side maybe should have gotten if this had been a free trade agreement more in line with the others, if it hadn't been foreign aid. And there are other big questions. People are questioning Fukushima, right? But reviewing all of the NUMEC documents, remember this smuggling operation in Pennsylvania? The Army Corps of Engineers says it's going to cost $170 million to clean up that nuclear waste. This is a U.S. plant that was the site of a lot of wrongdoing and a lot of sloppy operations. Another $250 million in liability suits. These are real consequences for policy ideas of enormous proportion. These are unresolved questions. Who should pay for this? Taxpayers? And so, at the end, the two books have very different ways of crunching data, to be sure, and they have very different policy outputs and recommendations. One of them recommends accountability. It recommends better law enforcement, less secrets. No more secret dealings, no more pretending there's an advice and consent process and inviting industries in to participate and get shafted and get the worst end of the deal in what's supposed to be an advice and consent process. The people who are going to make sure, of course, that we have better governance, better processes, are sitting in universities. And for that reason, I wanted to bring this to you, and I'd be happy to take any questions. So thanks for coming.